Welcome to Stories in the Shadows. Haunted tales from the golden age of ghost stories and supernatural fiction. I'm Ardell, and our final story this season is Behind the Curtain by Francis Stevens. It was after 9 o'clock when the bell rang, and descending to the dimly lighted hall, I opened the front door, at first on the chain, to be sure of my visitor, seeing as I had hoped the face of our friend Ralph Quentin. I took off the chain, and he entered with a blast of sharp November air for company. I had to throw my weight upon the door to close it against the wind. As he removed his hat and cloak, he laughed good-humoredly. "You're very cautious, Santelos. I thought you were about to demand a password before admitting me." "It is well to be cautious," I retorted. "This house stands somewhat alone, and thieves are everywhere." "It would take a thief of considerable muscle to make off with some of your treasures. That stone tomb thing, for instance, what do you call it? The Beni Hassan sarcophagus?" "Yes, but what of the gilded inner case? And what of the woman it contains, a thief of judgment and intelligence, might covet that treasure and strive to deprive me of it? Don't you agree?" He only laughed again and counterfeited a shudder. "The woman? Don't remind me that such a brown, shriveled mummy horror was ever a woman." "But she was. Doubtless in her day my poor princess of Nairn was soft, appealing, a creature of red, moist lips and eyes like stars in the black Egyptian sky. The songstress of the house, she was called, ere she became Tondazim the Osirian. But I keep you standing here in the cold hall. Come upstairs with me. Did I tell you that Beatrice is not here tonight?" "No." His intonation expressed surprise and frank disappointment. "Then I can't say goodbye to her. Didn't you receive my note? I'm to take Sanderson's place as manager of the sales department in Chicago, and I'm off tomorrow morning." "Congratulations, yes. We had your note, but Beatrice was given an opportunity to join some friends on a southern trip. The notice was short, but of late she has not been so well, and I urged her to go. This November air is cruelly damp and bitter."
"What was it, a yachting cruise?"
"A long cruise. She left this afternoon. I've been sitting in her boudoir, Quentin, thinking of her, and I'll tell you about it there, if you don't mind."
"Whatever you like," he conceded, though in a tone of some surprise.
I suppose he had not credited me with so much sentiment, or thought it odd that I should wish to share it with another, even so good a friend as he.
"You must find it fearfully lonesome here without B," he continued.
"A trifle." We were ascending the dark stairs now. "After tonight, however, things will be quite different. Do you know that I have sold the house?"
"No. Why, you were full of astonishments, old chap. Found a better place with more space for your tear jars and tombstones."
He meant, I assumed, a witty reference to my collection of Coptic and Egyptian treasures, well and dearly bought, but so much trash to a man of Quentin's youth and temperament. I opened the door of my wife's boudoir, and it was pleasant to pass into such rosy light and warmth out of the stern dark cold of the hall. Yet it was an old house full of unexpected draughts. Even here there was a draught so strong that a heavy velour curtain at the far side of the room continually rippled and billowed out, like a loose rose-colored sail, never far enough, though, to show what was behind it. My friend settled himself on the frail little chair that stood before my wife's dressing table. It was the kind of chair that women love and most men loathe, but Quentin, for all his weight and stature, had a touch of the feminine about him, or perhaps of the feline. Like a cat, he moved delicately. He was blonde and tall, with fine, regular features, a ready laugh, and the clean charm of youth about him. Also, its occasional, blundering candor. As I looked at him sitting there, graceful, at ease, I wished that his mind might have shared the litheness of his body. He could have understood me so much better. I have indeed found a place for my collections, I observed, seating myself nearby. In fact, with a single exception, the Ta-Nehisi sarcophagus. The entire lot is going to the dealers. Seeing his expression of astonished disbelief, I continued, "Oh, the truth is, my dear Quentin, that I have been guilty of gross injustice to our Beatrice. I have been too good a collector, and too neglectful a husband. My tear jars and tombstones, in fact, have enjoyed an attention that might have been better elsewhere bestowed. Yes, Beatrice has left me alone, but the instant that some few last affairs are settled, I intend rejoining her. And you yourself are leaving. At least, none of us three will be left to miss the other's friendship. You are quite surprising tonight, Santalos, but by Jove, I'm not sorry to hear any of it. It's not my place to criticize, and B is not the sort to complain, but living here in this lonely old barn of a house, doing all her own work, practically deserted by her friends, must have been hard. Very hard, I interrupted him softly, for one so young and lovely as our Beatrice. But if I have been blind, at least the awakening has come. You should have seen her face when she heard the news. It was wonderful. We were standing, just she and I, in the midst of my tear jars and tombstones, my chamber of horrors, she named it. You are so apt at amusing phrases, both of you. We stood beside the great stone sarcophagus from the necropolis of Beni Hassan. Across the trestles beneath it lay the gilded inner case, wherein Ta-Nehisi the Osirian had slept out so many centuries. You know its appearance, a thing of beautiful gleaming lines, like the quaint smiling image of a golden woman. Then I lifted the lid and showed Beatrice that the one-time songstress, the handmaiden of Amun, slept there no more, and the case was empty. You know, too, that Beatrice never liked my princess. For a jest, she used to declare that she was jealous. Jealous of a woman dead and ugly so many thousand years, but that was only in anger, that I had bought Ta-Nehisi with what would have given her, Beatrice, all the pleasure she lacked in life. Oh, she was not too patient to reproach me, Quentin, but only in anger and hot blood. So I showed her the empty case, and I said, "Beloved wife, never again need you be jealous of Ta-Nehisi. All that is in this room, save her and her belongings, I have sold. But her I could not bear to sell, that which I love. No man else shall share or own. So I have destroyed her. I have rent her body to brown aromatic shreds, I have burned her. It is as if she had never been. And now, dearest of the dear, you shall take for your own all the care, all the keeping that heretofore I have lavished upon the Princess of Niamh." Beatrice turned from the empty case as if she could scarcely believe her hearing, but when she saw by the look in my eyes that I meant exactly what I said, neither more nor less, you should have seen her face. My dear Quentin, you should have seen her face. I can imagine. He laughed rather shortly. For some reason, my guest seemed increasingly ill at ease and glanced continually about the little rose and white room that was the one luxurious, thoroughly feminine corner. That in the cold, dark room behind the curtain, in what he had justly called my barn of a house. "St. Alice," he continued abruptly, and I thought rather rudely, "you should have a portrait done as you look tonight. You might have posed for one of those stern old hidalgos of which painter was it who did so many Spanish dons and donnesses?" "You mean, perhaps, Velasquez," I answered with mild courtesy, though secretly and as always his crude personalities displeased me. "My father, you may recall, was a Cordova in southern Spain, but must you go so soon? First drink one glass with me to our missing Beatrice. See how I was warming my blood against the wind that blows in even here. The wine is Amontillado, some that was sent me by a friend of my father's from the very vineyards where the grapes were grown and pressed, and for many years it has ripened since it came here. Before she went, Beatrice drank of it from one of these same glasses. True wine of Montilla. See how it lives. Like a fire in amber, with a glimmer of blood behind it." I held high the decanter, and the light gleamed through it upon his face. "Amontillado, isn't that a kind of sherry? I'm no connoisseur of wines, as you know, but, Amontillado." For a moment he studied the wine I had given him, liquid flame in the crystal glass. Then his face cleared. "I remember the association now. The cask of Amontillado. Ever read the story?"
"I seem to recall it dimly."
"Horrible, fascinating sort of a yarn. A fellow takes his trustful friend down into the cellars to sample some wine, traps him and walls him up in a niche. Buries him alive, you understand. Read it when I was a youngster. And it made a deep impression, partly, I think, because I couldn't for the life of me comprehend a nature, even an Italian nature, desiring so horrible a form of vengeance. You're half Latin yourself, St. Alice. Can you elucidate?"
"I doubt if you would ever understand," I responded slowly, wondering how even Quentin could be so crude, so tactless. "Such a revenge might have its merits, since the offender would be a long time dying, but merely to kill seems to me so pitifully inadequate. Now I, if I were driven to revenge, should never be contented by killing. I should wish to follow."
"What, beyond the grave?" I laughed. "Why not? Wouldn't that be the very apotheosis of hatred?"
"I'm trying to interpret the Latin nature as you asked me to do."
"Confound you! For an instant I thought you were serious. The way you said it made me actually shiver."
"Yes," I observed. "Or perhaps it was the draft. See, Quentin, how that curtain billows out." His eyes followed my glance continually.
the heavy rose-colored curtain that was hung before the door of my wife's bedroom bulged outward, shook and quivered like a bellying sail, as draperies will with the wind behind them. His eyes strayed from the curtain, met mine, and fell again to the wine in his glass. Suddenly he drained it, not as would a man who was a judge of wines, but hastily, indifferently, without thought for its flavor or bouquet. I raised my glass, and the toast he had forgotten. "To our Beatrice," I said, and drained mine also, though with more appreciation. "And to Beatrice, of course." He looked at the bottom of his empty glass, then before I could offer to refill it, rose from his chair. "I must go, old man. When you write to be, tell her I'm sorry to have missed her." "Before she could receive a letter from me, I shall be with her, I hope. How cold the house is tonight, and the wind breathes everywhere. See how the curtain blows, Quentin." "So it does." He set his glass on the tray beside the decanter. Upon first entering the room, he had been smiling, but now his straight, fine brows were drawn in a perpetual, troubled frown. His eyes looked here and there, and would never meet mine, which were steady. "There's a wind," he added, "that blows along this wall. Curious. One can't notice any draft there either, but it must blow there, and of course the curtain billows out." "Yes," I said, "of course it billows out." "Or is there another door behind that curtain?" His careful ignorance of what any fool might infer from mere appearance brought an involuntary smile to my lips. Nevertheless, I answered him, "Yes, of course, there is a door. An open door." His frown deepened. My true and simple replies appeared to cause him a certain irritation. "As I feel now," I added, "even to cross the room would be an effort. I am tired and weak tonight. As Beatrice once said, my strength beside yours is as a child's to that of a grown man. Won't you close that door for me, dear friend?" "Why, yes, I will. I didn't know you were ill. If that's the case, you shouldn't be alone in this empty house. Shall I stay with you for a while?" As he spoke, he walked across the room. His hand was on the curtain, but before it could be drawn aside, my voice checked him. "Quentin," I said, "are even you quite strong enough to close that door?" Looking back at me, chin on shoulder, his face appeared scarcely familiar, so drawn was it in lines of bewilderment and half-suspicion. "What do you mean? You are very odd tonight. Is the door so heavy, then? What door is it?" I made no reply. As if against their owner's will, his eyes fled from mine. He turned and hastily pushed aside the heavy drapery. Behind it, my wife's bedroom lay dark and cold, with windows open to the invading winds. And erect in the doorway, uncovered, stood an ancient and gilded coffin case. It was the golden casket of Ta-Nehisi, but its occupant was more beautiful than the poor shriveled songstress of Naam. Bound across her bosom were the strange, quaint jewels which had been found in the sarcophagus, Ta-Nehisi's amulets, heads of Hathor and Horus, the sacred eye, the Aureus, even the heavy dull green scarab, the amulet for purity of heart. There they rested upon the bosom of her who had been mistress of my house, now Beatrice, the Osirian. Beneath them, her stiff, white body was enwrapped and the same crackling, dry, brown linen bands, impregnated with the gums and resins of embalmers, dead these many thousand years, which had been about the body of Ta-Nehisi. Above the white translucence of her brow appeared the winged disc, emblem of Ra. The twining golden bodies of its supporting Aureli, its cobras of Egypt, were lost in the dusk of her hair, whose soft fineness yet lived, and would live, so much longer than the flesh of any of us three. Yes, I had kept my word, and given to Beatrice all that had been Ta-Nehisi's, even to the sarcophagus itself, for in my will it was written that she be placed in it for final burial. Like the fool he was, Quentin stood there, staring at the unclosed, frozen eyes of my Beatrice, and his. Stood till that which had been in the wine began to make itself felt. He faced me then, but with so absurd and childish a look of surprise, that despite the courtesy due a guest, I laughed and laughed. I too felt warning throes, but to me the pain was no more than a gauge, a measure of his suffering, stimulus to point the phrases in which I told him all I knew and had guessed of him and Beatrice, and thus drive home the jest. But I had never thought that a man of Quentin's youth and strength could die so easily. Beatrice, frail though she was, had taken longer to die. He could not even cross the room to stop my laughter, but at the first step stumbled, fell, and in a very little while lay at the foot of the gilded case. After all, he was not so strong as I. Beatrice had seen. Her still, cold eyes saw all. How he lay there, his fine, lithe body contorted, worthless for any use, till its substance should have been cast again in the melting pot of dissolution, while I, who had drunk of the same draught, suffered the same pangs, yet stood and found breath for mockery. So I poured myself another glass of that good Cordovan wine, and I raised it to both of them, and draining it, laughing. "Quentin," I cried, "you asked, what door? Though your thought was that you had passed that way before, and feared that I had guessed your knowledge. But there are doors, and doors, dear, charming friend, and one that is heavier than any other. Close it, if you can. Close it now in my face. Who otherwise will follow even whither you have gone, the heavy, heavy door of the Osiris, keeper of the house of death." Thus I dreamed of doing and speaking. It was so vivid, the dream, that awakening in the darkness of my room, I could scarcely believe that it had been other than reality. True, I lived while in my dream I had shared the avenging poison, yet my veins were still hot with the keen passion of triumph, and my eyes filled with the vision of Beatrice dead, dead in Ta-Nehisi's casket. Unreasonably frightened, I sprang from the bed, flung on a dressing gown, and hurried out. Down the hallway I sped swiftly and silently. At the end of it, unlocked heavy doors with a tremulous hand, switched on lights, lights, and more lights, till the great room of my collection was ablaze with them. And as my treasures sprang into view, I sighed like a man reaching home from a perilous journey. The dream was a lie. There fronting me stood the heavy, empty sarcophagus. There on the trestles before it lay the gilded case, a thing of beautiful, gleaming lines, like the smiling image of a golden woman. I stole across the room, and softly, very softly lifted the upper half of the beautiful lid, peering within. The dream, indeed, was a lie. Happy as a comforted child, I went to my room again. Across the hall, the door of my wife's boudoir stood partly open. In the room beyond, a faint light was burning, and I could see the rose-colored curtain sway slightly to a draft from some open window. Yesterday she had come to me and asked for her freedom. I had refused, knowing to whom she would turn and hating him for his youth, and his crudeness and his secret scorn of me. But had I done well? They were children, those two, and despite my dream, I was certain that their foolish youthful ideals had kept them from actual sin against my honor. But what if, time passing, they might change, or Quentin gone, my lovely Beatrice might favor another, young as he and not so scrupulous. Everyone, they say, has a streak of incipient madness. I recalled the frenzied act to which my dream jealousy had driven me. Perhaps it was a warning, the dream. What if my father's jealous blood should some day betray me, drive me to the insane destruction of her I held most dear and sacred? I shuddered, then smiled at the swaying curtain. Beatrice was too beautiful for safety. She should have her freedom. Let her mate with Ralph Quentin or whom she would. Tanazem must rest secure in her gilded house of death. My brown, perfect, shriveled princess of the Nile. Destroyed, rent to brown aromatic shreds, burned, destroyed, in her beautiful coffin case desecrated, as I had seen in my vision. Again I shuddered, smiled, and shook my head sadly at the swaying rosy curtain. "You're too lovely, Beatrice," I said, "and my father was a Spaniard. You shall have your freedom." I entered my room and lay down to sleep again, at peace and content. The dream, thank God, was a lie. Please join me next season for a tale of grisly murder I hope you won't find too distasteful. Sweeney Todd, here on Stories from the Shadows. Until then, I wouldn't blame you if you leave the lights on.